Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Dorothy Bass, and she will be speaking on manna in the wilderness. So let's listen in on Dorothy.
Note that the summer theme is a foretaste of the feast to come. And to help us all to remember that the image of feast is a wonderful image that runs really throughout the biblical text as coalescing the kind of promise and hope that the people of God have for their future. In the Gospel of Luke, there will be a day when people will come from north and south and east and west and feast in the kingdom of God. So the feast is a very strong biblical image of hope. And yet it's only a foretaste. Also throughout biblical faith, there's a sense that we're yearning for the fulfillment. We're not all the way there yet. It seems to me that part of the power of this image of feast and part of the reason that this theme is so interesting is that it comes to people in our situation, our world, where feast is only one of the ways that people relate to banquets and to food. There are people who starve. There are famines. There are people who sit under the table and catch the scraps. And then there are people who, you know, stuff their faces and are bad for their health and for society and everything else. There's gluttony. And feasting, it seems to me, is different from gluttony, and it's different from starvation. And in the world in which we live, all of those relationships to eating exist. And feast is a sign of a hopeful way of thinking about all of that. Now, on this first Bible study of the summer, I decided to look at one of the first stories in the Bible, one of the oldest texts we're told by scholars in the Hebrew Scriptures about eating. And that is the story in Exodus 16. It's the story of the manna in the wilderness. Familiar story. And just to lead up to this story, let's remember where we are in the longer story of what God is doing with human beings. If we think about that story, we'll see that we already have some themes of famine and feast going in the story before we get to this point. Remember that, last night we had the story of the Tower of Babel. And after the confusion of the peoples, God had chosen one people who would bless, through whom to bless all the nations, had led Abraham into a land of promise, where Abraham had grown wealthy, and his children, Isaac, and then Jacob with him. Jacob had 12 sons who were the parents of the 12 tribes of Israel. A famine came upon their good land, and they went where? Remember? Where did they go to find food?
Egypt.
They got to Egypt, found plenty to eat. In fact, prospered and multiplied, became so numerous that Pharaoh became frightened of them and cast them into bondage. Where they were not feasting, they were catching the scraps while Pharaoh feasted. God heard their cries and raised up Moses to lead them out. They didn't have time even to leaven their bread. As they made their way, they took along snacks, should we say, right through the Red Sea, traveling quickly. It's a wonderful thing that since that time, the Jewish people have made of that snack, you know, that quick meal, a major occasion for feasting every year in that community on Passover. And by chapter 15, we've got the people of Israel through the Red Sea into freedom, but in a wilderness. Chapter 15 ends up almost with the song of Moses and then of Miriam, Moses' sister, sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. Great celebration. And yet in the very next little paragraph, the people start to grumble and murmur because they're thirsty. Oh, God, Moses, you let us out here. We have nothing to drink. We're thirsty. God provides water. That seems fine, but now we're to chapter 16, and they're going to grumble again. And this is the chapter that I want to look at today with you. I think we all have the same Bible text. That's good. The Revised Standard Version. Not that it's the best, but it's what we all have. We're together on this, and let's start. If I'm going to ask each person to or volunteers to read short sections, and we'll stop and discuss each section. Okay? Would someone read the first three verses of this chapter 16?
They set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. On the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt, the whole congregation of the people of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness and said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly of hunger."
Grumbling. But after all, 45 days with no food, I suppose they would be have cause to do so by that time. Any feasts here? What images of eating do we get in these three verses? What do you see here?
Do you mean in the...
Just in where the we are now, in the text, we've got...
Flesh pots and bread to the full, I guess.
Yeah.
The food I see.
They're reflecting back on what they...
Have
time of plenty.
Yeah. And now they've got starvation. Now they've got hunger. And then they had the flesh pots of Egypt. It's one of the great images of, it's often used in literature, you know, the flesh pots of Egypt as a, and bread to the full.
But they really weren't that well off in Egypt.
Right.
Just like the olden days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Not what I would call a feast, which is a celebration with food, right? But maybe closer to flesh pots of Egypt.
The basics are...
Yeah, yeah. Flesh pots of... Well, there's a certain, almost a kind of gluttony that's suggested by the flesh pots of Egypt. I don't know if that's right. That's a kind of where you have plenty to eat, but you've lost your humanity is debased in the process.
I think that people put a lot of emphasis on meat as opposed to, the fact that
that's
they
true.
Just speak of bread and meat or meat and bread.
Yes. Things
that really have a lot of other nourishment.
Right.
Still.
Right. Right. There's a in the town we live in, which is a county seat town in northwest Indiana, Valparaiso, very much a predominantly white town. There is a small, predominantly African-American congregation which has begun in the last 5 years, and I often worship there. And it's composed primarily of people who kind of together, deliberately, knowing one another, decided to make a better life for themselves than they could have in South Chicago, and to come and to try to be in community in the town of Valparaiso and to form a worshiping community. And some other churches have helped with this. Well, the minister has talked about this. When people get yearning for the south side of Chicago again, has used this text many times. Yes, it's a wilderness out here, but we're going the way we need to be going. And, you miss the rib joints, you miss certain things that were comfortable and presumably nourishing, there, but we're doing the right thing for our children here. See, and it's hard. So he talks about the flesh pots of Egypt as what it was like for them back in the south side of Chicago, and it's a great image. Okay, so we've got the interplay of food and starvation going in the lives of the people, but we don't yet have a feast. May I ask someone now to read from 4 through 12? Jan, would you like to do that?
Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, "At evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your murmurings against the Lord. For what are we, that you murmur against us?" And Moses said, "When the Lord gives you in the evening flesh to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your murmurings which you murmur against him, what are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord." And Moses said to Aaron, "Say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your murmurings." And as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the murmurings of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God."
Thank you. Well, it's clear that God here has plans to feed the people. God's not planning to let them perish. But there's a lot more going on than simply the provision of food. And what other kinds of things do you see God doing with the people in this passage?
They need to learn to trust.
Uh-huh, right, right.
Discipline.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Prove, that old word prove.
There's a little bit of proof in here, I think.
Uh-huh.
A little bit of, in the evening you shall know that there was mm-hmm. the Lord your God. In uh-huh. the evening, by evening you're going to know.
Right.
You will remember
right.
that it was God.
Right, right.
It wasn't your own will or sticks and stones or luck that got you out of here. It was the Lord who led you out.
Uh-huh.
And when you murmur against God.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Ouch.
Right. Right. The leaders always take it on the, you know, hear the grumbling, but actually, yeah, they're murmuring against God. Also the sense of God's going to test the people, prove the people, test the people to see if they can follow instructions. I mean, this is a new relationship here. This is before the Ten Commandments are even given. And God is trying to prepare this people to be a sign to the nations and so on. And they're not real fast learners, shall we say.
like us.
Like us, that's right. Not fast learners. You know, but look at all that's been done. And they're not fast learners.
I think it's a good text to remind us, so many people say that you have to experience something to learn something.
Uh-huh.
Or you have to, you know, you have to have this experience of the Lord in order to make it stick.
Uh-huh.
Well, they've had experiences in enormous ways, pillars of clouds, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they've been let out, they had the plagues, and here still, now they're hungry.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know what it's like to be that hungry, but I'm sure it's miserable, but
uh-huh.
experiential stuff sometimes doesn't stay that long, so.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
I mean, you know, for all, well,
it's
you
not always a sure thing.
No,
sure
no.
Right.
That you're being tested by faith, which is something that you can't see often and very seldom experience. You kind of walk around. So I think this is also talking about lack of faith and trust.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
But it's a counter-argument to some of that experiential stuff that a lot of people say is so important, you know, for the faith. And I'd like to always point back to this text
yeah.
and say, well, maybe.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. That's prompting me. The blinding experience, I mean, the passage, the one-time big moment.
Right.
isn't going to do it.
No.
So what does God devise instead? Something they're going to do every single day for 40 years. Okay? And let's get to, in other words, habit, long habit,
yeah,
is going to be God's way of forming them, but rather than a big zap.
After that, they still...
That's true. Even after that, they still... Right. But God is going to try to...
But
you're
yeah,
right,
no,
they
he,
do always.
He is, yeah.
But God is going to try this other approach, which is a 40 years of daily habituation to a certain way of life, which has a certain content to it. And let's, let's go from 13 to 21 now. Would you like to, Miss Pink Shirt?
My name's Liz.
Liz, hi.
13 to 21. Mm-hmm. And it came to pass that at even the quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay round about the host. And when the dew that lay was gone up, behold, the face of the wilderness, there lay a small round thing, as small as the hoar frost on the ground. And when the children of Israel saw it, they said one to another, "It is manna," for they wist not what it was. And Moses said to them, "This is the bread which the Lord hath given you to eat. This is the thing which the Lord hath commanded. Gather of it every man according to his eating, an omer for every man according to the number of your persons. Take ye every man for them which are in his tents." And the children of Israel did so, and gathered some more, some less. And when they did meet it with an omer, he had gathered much, had nothing over, and he had gathered little, had no lack. They gathered every man according to his eating. And Moses said, "Let no man leave of it till morning." Notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto Moses, but some of them left of it until morning, and it bred worms and stank, and Moses was wroth with them. And they gathered it every morning, every man according to his eating, and when the sun waxed hot, it melted.
Mm-hmm. That's King James.
Yes.
But there's some beautiful language in it. Beautiful language. But we all have the point. It's a familiar story. Mm-hmm. But let's see what we can learn about biblical, you know, God's plan for human consumption from this, at least during this trial period, from this story. Interesting factoid here. The word manna is tied in its Hebrew root to the phrase, "What is it?"
Is it?
Yeah.
Wow, that's neat.
Yeah. What is it? That's manna. So they found on the ground, "What is it?" There's been lots of speculation about that, but I think that's not the important thing. Okay, how much for each person?
What they needed.
Mm-hmm. What they needed. And mm-hmm. Yes.
For that day.
For that day.
Uh huh. No more.
Right. Equally. For that day. Okay. Any hoarding here?
They tried.
They tried, but it works. I mean, since God has built into nature here some of the instructive elements that God wishes to communicate, which words alone cannot communicate. We try to do this with children, I suppose. You know, you try to structure lives in ways that they learn virtue. They learn what's right and good by what they actually have in a physical sense. The equality, the dailiness of it. Any reflections on that dailiness, and ring any bells?
The Lord's Prayer.
Yeah. Daily bread. There was a pastor in here at the first session, who's Peter Homer, who's teaching about the 12-step movement in relationship to Christianity, in some of the teaching sessions this week. And he pointed out the one day at a time spiritual approach of Alcoholics Anonymous and movements of that sort. You have to trust God's grace for the day, and you can't save it up for the next day. You know, know, it's a matter of each day trusting. You know, maybe God won't have any tomorrow. That's not the point. So in a sense, I mean, it's about food, but it's also about it's also about relationships and community and how much it can be spiritual, it can be kind of socioeconomic, it's all there.
Yeah, if you gather too much, somebody won't have enough. And if you gather more than you need, somebody won't have enough. Certainly a socioeconomic.
And in the end, it won't do you any good.
Right.
In fact, it will go bad.
Yeah. I think that it stank in the King James.
Yeah.
It had worms
in it.
What's
the word in
stank?
Foul.
It became
worms and became foul.
Stank is much
less. Yeah, right. Okay,
also, at that point, some of the people were deciding they knew a better, an improvement on what God had told them to do. We do a lot of it.
Let's look at the next section. Then I'll open up this text to some other perspectives, okay? 22 to 30. Someone, would you read that?
On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers apiece. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil. And all that is left over lay by to be kept till the morning." So they laid it by till morning, as Moses bid them. And it did not become foul, and there were no worms in it. Moses said, "Eat it today, for today is the Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it in, and on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be no more." On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, and they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain every man of you in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day.
Okay. Now, you know, we all know that in the Bible the week has 7 days, right? And that the Sabbath pattern is there right from the first chapter of our canon. This is one of the earliest texts, though, in the Bible, which even prefigures that. Now think about this for a minute. Is this God, in a sense, this is a bigger test of trust than the previous portion, right? And it could seem arbitrary. Right? It's hard, sometimes time seems so natural, we're so used to the way that we live. You almost think that there have to be 7 day weeks. Right? But not everybody in the world has always had 7 day weeks. You know, it's like the globe doesn't come with lines where the maps, you know, where the nation states should be. And the natural world by itself doesn't necessarily have to be divided into 7 day segments of time. So is God being arbitrary in this, or are there deep meanings embedded in this 7 day pattern? In one sense, as a test for the people, you could see it as an arbitrary thing. But of course, you know, the Bible wants to say that there's a deep meaning in this pattern, which can be discovered, and that God, in a sense, is teaching these people a shared pattern of life through which certain true things about who they are and who God is will become apparent to them by the very way that they live. any, I'm gonna take you into a different part of the Bible at this point, but any other reflections on this, on what you see in this, in any of these verses, or? God is training them for a covenant, covenant life. And yes, they're still going to be slow learners. It's going to get worse before it gets better, and then it'll get worse again, you know. But so are we. Do you know that? I'm going to have us look now at the Sabbath commandment and see what actually the content of the teaching of these commandments, of this commandment as it appears in the two different places in the Old Testament. Do you know that this is the longest commandment? The one that Lutherans call the third, I think. Other people call the fourth. Yes. We can discuss that after. And it's different. It's the only one that's different in Exodus and Deuteronomy. I think this is very interesting. I don't know if you've ever, have you noticed this before? It's really quite quite intriguing that it's different. It's the longest one, and it's different in Exodus and Deuteronomy. Okay, one rendering is going to be in Exodus 20, starting at the 8th verse. See, this is only a little while after we have left the people on the wilderness of sin. Would someone read that?
Which verse?
Starting verse 8 through 11.
Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you will labor and do all your work, but on the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your cattle, wait a minute, I lost my spot. Your servant, your maidservant, or your cattle, or the sojourner who is within your gate. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that, let's just, to get the contrast, let's look at Deuteronomy 5. Starting at the 12th verse. Another volunteer here.
Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your manservant or your maidservant or your ox or your ass or any of your cattle or the sojourner who is within your gates, that your manservant and your maidservant may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were a servant in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out thence with an arm, a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day.
Okay. You see the difference? What you're supposed to do is the same in both, right? No work. And not only you, but everybody.
Even the animals.
Even the animals.
Wow.
Right. God intends rest for creation, right?
Everyone. Martin Luther loved to talk about this text to remember that God loved and took care of animals as well. But,
mm-hmm.
But I just like to point that out with children because they uh-huh. are so close with, but that God cared for them as much and wanted their well-being too.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's neat. I'll have to point that out. But you see the difference. What are the different reasons, though? We're on Deuteronomy, so let's stay there. Why? What's going on? If you were in a community that followed this commandment, what would you learn in your very weekly behavior? You'd be learning something. You'd be remembering something. the Jewish prayers at the beginning of the Sabbath, thank you for the work of this week. And you think of people who are unemployed now. And the goodness of work becomes apparent in the Sabbath, as well as the need to stop from it once in a while. This is a, you should remember that you were a servant in the land of Egypt. Yes, God has taken care of your family, but your family is related to, you know, has had an experience of bondage.
So treat your servants better than you were treated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Take some time off.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And, yes, that's right. Right. Treat your servants better than you were treated. There's one of the Jewish commentaries reflecting upon this points out, slaves can't take a day off. I mean, this shows that you are God's free people. Slaves cannot take a day off. And so in taking a day off, you replicate your freedom. You know, you remember your freedom. You don't take it for granted. And I think this, I mean, I see this as a real liberate, you know, having some messages of social liberation. You know, for people who work too much, people who don't have work at all, you know. Do you have a comment?
I'll tell her not to work so much, and she said she's going to tell a colleague of hers. Uh-huh. Works even harder than she does.
Uh-huh.
Oh, well, I have some colleagues that just, you know, it seems that their whole life is wrapped up in their work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the main focus of their life.
Uh-huh.
Well, they'll call her up at 9 o'clock at night and 7 o'clock in the morning.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And it's not always that
crucial. Right. Well, no, I'll tell you, I've been doing a lot of research on Sabbath keeping, and it started for me about 2 years ago when my husband and I are both professors. We were out with another couple who were professors, and we realized that everyone was planning to spend the next after. We were going to church Sunday morning, but then we were planning to spend the day grading papers. And I just thought, it just hit me. And everyone I know does this. It's your one chance to catch up. And I just thought, it just hit me, if we violated any of the other commandments as blithely, as unthinkingly as we do that one, we would not feel good. I mean, we would feel, that's not to say we never violate them, you know, because we do. And it's not to say our salvation lies in them, and doesn't, but it is to say that if we went around bearing false witness and committing adultery and all this stuff, I mean, we would at least feel like we ought to be changing our behavior. And this one, we just could kiss off, you know? And I really had to wonder about that. And it got me started on doing all this study. Really, I think there's something. Okay, but Nan, is it just an arbitrary thing? Is it just because it's God's commandment and just because we have to, like, bow down and follow these orders? Or is there something much more embedded here? See, that's what I'm getting at with these two different forms of the commandment. There is something very deep embedded here. There's a whole sense of freedom and liberation on the one hand, which is social as well as personal, embedded here in the way that we live or don't live, right?
Yeah.
There's a whole theology of being free people and not being slaves.
I have a friend of mine who's a pastor that says this, for him, the Sabbath day is the best, one of the best witnesses he can have, rather than, I mean, his is a public ministry. As is mine, I'm ordained too, but he says to have people see me laying in a hammock reading, you know, fiction, or out mowing my lawn and sitting on the front porch and having a beer,
uh-huh.
might be one of the best witnesses, because I'm when mowing the lawn isn't a very good example.
Right.
Whoops! Uh-huh. But he said also it's a witness for him that I'm leaning on God's grace now, and I don't have to do anything to earn it.
Right.
And he said,
right.
And that's a liberating
that's
thought.
Right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. So that's a free thought too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And certainly our grandparents and
further back, they lived this a lot better than we did. Uh-huh. In that, I can just remember that Sunday was a whole day of family and fun and doing things together, naps, right, having a nap, having you know, refreshments together several times a day, or meals, and the whole day.
Right.
I mean, we were recently up in the hill country of Texas, and they had these houses near the church where they would come into, what were they, what were those?
Sunday houses.
They were called Sunday houses. And they lived in outlying farm and ranch area. But on Saturday evening, they would drive into town and spend the night in one of these Sunday houses.
They're really small.
Just a little bedroom house-like. Where they would be, so that in the morning, they would be ready to worship. They would be at the church. And then they'd spend the whole day on the grounds with the community of believers. And then they would drive back to their farms. So they actually had houses in town to accommodate.
What denomination was this, or do you know?
Lutherans there.
Near Fredericksburg.
Interesting.
Those are all towns you know very often.
Fredericksburg, Texas, which is a very
interesting town. But But you know, the in the Bible, it's very clear that days go from evening to evening. Also, and I found this, I am really, my next session tonight and tomorrow, I'm going to talk about really practical Sabbath keeping. But I am really trying to observe this. But it is easier from Saturday evening to Sunday evening. You know, to really say, okay, supper time Saturday, supper time Sunday will be a time when I do not enter stores. I do not pay bills. I do not order from catalogs. You know, I do not do laundry. These are the things. I mean, everybody would have to have their own things that they thought were the violation, because I don't think we're under a law about this at this point
For you.
But those are the, you know, that I really try to decommercialize our family's life for that period of time. And then I think, frankly, you know, Sunday night, I kind of have to get ready for Monday, but I feel better about it having taken that 24-hour period.
Have you thought about the concept that the Jews are always ahead of us? Because the day starts and they go to bed. The day starts at sundown. So they go to bed and they wake up. Hey, you know, day's half over, got a lot of energy.
That's right.
Our day starts in the morning when we get up and and we're just barely creeping in. We go downhill all day and we're always catching up from the day before.
Right.
But conceptually, they're starting the day by going to bed.
Right. And
maybe that's why many of them do so well. Maybe that's why you're doing so well. It sounds like you're doing the same thing.
Yeah, well, in a sense, in the Talmud, I read a lot of the Jewish commentary on this stuff, and the whole rabbinic tradition of reflection on, okay, well then, if we're not supposed to work, what can we do? What can't we do? What does it mean? There's a whole wisdom tradition about this, which is very intriguing. But see, the proof then is that God has been doing all the work for those first 12 hours before we get started. See? So it's already started, and so we then get up and pitch in. You know, the grass has been growing, the fruit has been ripening, you know, it's all been happening, and we get up and add our labors to creation rather than like, okay, let's gear it up. You know, there's a certain testimony of grace, even in nature, about that. Isn't that nice?
Well, it's kind of messed that up as electricity. You know, they agree you would go to bed pretty soon after sundown. I guess they could stay up with their lamps and their candles, but not like some people present who stay up very late, including myself.
Well, on Sabbath, one of the major laws of the Jewish Sabbath, which I'm going to discuss this evening, is do not light.
Oh, really?
Do not light a fire.
Oh, really?
Yes. So, well-to-do Jews in Eastern Europe would hire Christians to come in and turn off the lights, on and off the lights at the end of the day. You know, there's a certain you know, do not light a fire. There's a whole logic behind this, which we'll discuss later.
Even more recently, my grandfather's walking down the street one day, and a man stuck his head out the window and called him over and said, would you turn off my hose?
Uh-huh.
And he said, yeah, glad to.
Uh-huh.
But, you know,
uh-huh.
He said, fine, why don't you turn off your own hose? He said, well, it's a Sabbath. Mm-hmm. I forgot to turn mm-hmm. it off mm-hmm. before the Sabbath.
There's
oh,
a
that
whole...
was really orthodox. Yeah. That was really an orthodox.
Right, right. Right, but there's some very... Stuff. Some very deep thoughtfulness about this. Now, and for that, let's look back at, okay, there's the whole sense of liberation. And also you find in Jewish literature a sense on the Sabbath all are equal because we're not, you know, not working or the categories of class drop away because of this at the commandment in Deuteronomy. But in Exodus 20, back to the other version, a different reason, a different kind of theology that supports stopping working at this. This is the more traditional, the more familiar, I should say, theology of Sabbath. This starts at the verse 11, the different part starts. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Now, did God stop after 6 days because God was tired? God had no more creative power, creative energy? Think back on Genesis. No. God, why did God stop?
To rest.
To rest. Okay, why at that point?
Hmm? The work was done.
The work was done. It was finished. There was no need to make anything better than this. This was good. You know, the man, the woman, this was all the, you know, we didn't need any more creatures. This was wonderful, as
so
it was.
We should look at our weeks as units, maybe. Is that part of it?
Perhaps. That might be part of what we would hear here. So God rested, in a sense, rest, not because of, like, total exhaustion.
Are there any psychological studies that say that 6 days is, you know, time for renewal, has anybody done anything like that? I wonder if there's some natural.
I don't know. Don't know.
6 days is about all you know.
No, I don't know about that. But clearly, in ancient society, I mean, really ancient societies, nomadic societies, they couldn't stop. I mean, they went on and on, and there might have been times related to the moon or, you know, other natural demarcations which would separate one time from another. But there was not a pattern of rest built into human society from the beginning. You know, and it's only in a, you know, when it's kind of settling down that these kind of patterns could become real. But here God's preparing the people for a life in the land. You know, in the manna story, in the wandering in the wilderness. Here the creation reason. In a sense, what I hear in this, when you stop, you will be imitating who? God.
And this is a little more of an obedience reason, isn't it? I mean, God did it, and you should do it. And the other one is, hey, look at but freeze you up.
Oh, let's talk about that. Is it an arbitrary obedience? That's a suggestion. There is clearly a sense that God is God. Mm-hmm. You are creature. God is setting up boundaries around this time. You must observe them. This is holy stuff. Set apart by God.
I was just struck, and I guess have been before, but that God didn't say, well, I'm going to build a deck and add another room and mm-hmm. go out and uh-huh. landscape part of this land
uh-huh.
or do all the stuff that I tend to do in my yard when I think I'm done. As soon as I'm finished sitting on the back porch, I'm already looking out to see what I can do next week to improve that.
You're speaking to me.
She's assuming the confessional posture. that this is enough. Mm-hmm. And And mm-hmm. I don't live by that very well. Even when I work on papers, you know, I tend to, you tinker till you think mm-hmm. it's never done. And I hear a lot of people say in their work, no matter what they're in, my mother right now is a pretty hands-on grandparent. She says, our work is never done. I say, but Mom, it is. You know, leave some, leave it. But I think one of the real simple but powerful messages in this passage for me is that God is saying, I could create a few more things. I mean, uh-huh. That's one of his best things to do is create. But he's saying it, and he says, it's good. And he rests. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, God can uh-huh. do it. I don't have to go mm-hmm. build a deck.
uh-huh.
You know, it's kind of uh-huh. it's not only a work thing, but I also think it's a consumption thing.
Yes.
He stops.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know
that's
if anybody helpful. Else feels like
I think that's a great reading, and that ties back into the manna story as well.
Yeah,
I mean to get a sense of
wanting more and more.
Yes, yes, yes.
Or doing more and more and more. I mean, there's wanting, but mm-hmm. there's also
doing. Yeah,
cranking out.
Yes.
Well, there's the work ethic that gets
sure
into mm-hmm. all of this that we need to do
sure.
the best we can.
I'm mm-hmm. interviewing for jobs right now, and I know I've talked to people. What are people looking for? And they somebody with energy.
Yeah, energy.
Like you got to bounce in.
Yeah.
Well, I work really hard.
Yeah.
But what if you went in and evoked this commandment and said, I work really hard, but I also take big rests, and sometimes I'm finished and I think this is enough. What if uh-huh. you said that?
Uh-huh.
Here's the door.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But actually, it's interesting. I just read some things about how you conduct yourself when you are being
programmed. And maybe we don't.
Yeah, I was thinking more about getting those papers graded for Monday
yes.
morning
yes.
that need to be turned back.
Yes, they do, yeah.
To students who are waiting
right.
for them. That
right.
needs to be done on Friday before Saturday.
Yes, we have obligations to others which are important and which are more important than the keeping of rules. And yet to live lives that ignore, see, I would argue that, and the Jewish tradition clearly would argue, and I think it's right, that there's a deep attitude towards creation, towards being created, towards receiving creation as a gift in this Exodus version, saying, yes, we'll be with it, you know, and enjoy it, and not alter it today. You know, the creation gets tugged at and worked out a lot, and it's not always good for the creation that such is the case, right? Mm-hmm. To be with it, to enjoy it, as God did. I mean, the first when God was finished, God stops and says, "This is good. I'm going to sit still and look at it for a while." You know, and that's a wonderful. I think there's a whole understanding. I guess in living this way, I think there's a whole understanding of who God is and what God intends for people and for creation, who we really are involved in this. In this commandment, which we just forget. And part of that is creation, and part of it is liberation. Now, I think for Christians then, how this becomes transformed in a certain way, I mean, continuous with the Old Testament and yet different from, which is always the case, trying to figure out Christian theology, where resurrection is added in. You know, and it's even more wonderful in a sense. I mean, you still could receive creation as a gift. You still need to know about liberation, but there's also now a shift to a different day of the week and a resurrection motif, you know, a resurrection reality as part of the part of what we can celebrate. So it's not just blowing it off. I don't see how to really rest in the sense of letting go of worry without making that an act of worship. How do you ever not worry? How do I ever not worry without worshiping? In a sense, letting go of worries is almost the definition of worship. I mean, sort of trusting that God, that my shortcomings are overcome, you know, that God's on watch in the universe, that my efforts are not sufficient to save. No, and those are acts of worship, which I think then need to be combined with acts of corporate worship on the resurrection day for Christians. And you know, that so it all becomes a way of living which speaks deeply to the biblical notion of who we are in God's